And I looked around me and I just saw more plastic bags than fish. And I was quite disappointed by that. And then I thought, why can't we just clean this up?
Okay, so Buren, thank you so much for taking the time here in Davos. It's a crazy schedule, isn't it, for you too?
Yes.
Yeah.
Good
So
to see you.
we're sitting in the top floor of this tiny chalet now on a field.
Yeah.
Everybody is ram-packed with meetings. Every minute counts.
For sure.
You just came into the room, and I think the quote of the day was already you've already done it, and I'm just going to repeat it for everybody who's listening, because I said that one of my previous guests was Ross Edgley, who swam around the whole of Great Britain in one go, just going onto the boat for sleeping and then
Sure.
swimming all day long for 3 months. And then your comment was, if you could repeat it,
Yeah.
please.
Well, it's always a relief to see that there's other people that are crazier than I am. It's quite a relief. Yeah.
Where did that I wanted to go back a little bit, because for all of us, finding this purpose and this drive and what we're dedicated to in life is a challenge sometimes. I was lucky that I found something very clear, but now again in my second life I'm looking, searching again, and that's why. And I know most people are searching for their purpose as well, and I want to touch on you, how I think it's really amazing how so early on you found such a clear direction, and maybe touch a little bit on where those inspirations you think came from. What were the first moments which pushed you like so committed into this path of yours?
I feel quite fortunate that I've been able to find my passion relatively early in life. It really came, well, really quite early. When I was 2 years old, I think I was already building things, making things. So when I was two, the first thing that I built was my own chair that I could kind of sit on, because I thought it was more fun to sit in your self-built chair than on a chair you could buy.
What did it do better than the chair that you can buy? Nothing?
Nothing really bad. I think it was pretty much objectively a worse chair than one you could buy. But it was just the feeling of, having an idea, seeing that picture in your head, and then being able to make it and to see it in reality and to touch it, and that to me was really, sort of the satisfaction. And I suppose I've been kind of a creator, inventor, since then. So things went from, sort of DIY stuff to computers to explosives. My parents especially loved that phase.
Guinness World Records
Yeah,
with explosives.
well, so that went to rocketry. So that, well, rocketry may be a big word, but just building sort of pressurized rockets. And then indeed, when it was 12 or 13, I said, well, let's try and launch 213 of them at the same time. And managed to do that and got into the Guinness Book of Records. And yeah, so I always really had my projects and just making crazy things. It wasn't very useful. It was just lots of fun to do. Yeah, and then I was 16, went scuba diving in Greece, looked around me, and I was sort of conditioned to expect these beautiful sceneries like you see in the BBC documentaries. And I looked around me and I just saw more plastic bags than fish. And I was quite disappointed by that. And then I thought, why can't we just clean this up? And can I combine my passion for science and technology, making things, with solving this problem that I see here?
That's amazing, huh? How one moment like that can be then so significant for life's course in your
Yeah,
case as well.
things changed since then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then so you, at 16, you decide, okay, I'm dropping out of school or education and I'm gonna make this happen. Like, isn't
Well,
that's so courageous, no? Like, how did
yeah,
it
so
take a
the
lot of courage, or?
Well, it took a year and a half before I actually dropped out. So I was still in high school back then, and decided to first do to do this high school science project end of the year. You basically got 20% of your time to do a project of your choice, and I thought this was amazing. You could use school time to do something you're passionate about, just to dig into this plastic problem and studying why people said that it couldn't be cleaned, and thinking about possible solutions. So that took about a year, then enrolled in aerospace engineering at the Delft University of Technology. And then, really, although it was, really, really quite interesting, I still couldn't stop thinking about this problem. So after half a year, I said, well, let's drop out. And if it doesn't work out, I can always come back after a semester and continue the studies. But yeah, that wasn't what happened.
I think that's an interesting one, that the people who have a lot of courage, they always do keep like a plan B in the back of their head, which they build up and make that look like, okay, that won't be too bad if that happens.
Right.
I mean, and that will give you, and that gives you courage to try plan A.
Sure.
And because your fallback is actually not too bad. So you did that in a way, yeah?
It didn't really feel like a very high risk decision. You know, first of all, by having that backup plan, but secondly, you know, I was very young. I don't have a mortgage, no family, no obligations. So really, yeah, it was kind of the worst thing that could happen. I think, you know, if you want to do something risky and, you know, do a startup or anything of the sorts, really sort of early 20s is actually a really good time to do that.
Can you take us through a little bit about the specifics of the problem? So there's this, of course, the great garbage patch, but why is it so difficult to remove it? And what is the negative impact that it's having in the Pacific Ocean?
Sure. Yeah. So plastic pollution is really an issue because of three reasons. First of all, it's destroying ecosystems. So there's roughly 800 species negatively impacted by plastic pollution right now. Then you have the economic impact. We just published a paper that showed that it's up to $19 billion per year damaging the global economy.
When you say we, who is that?
So it was our science team combined with Deloitte. Okay. So, yeah, it was a few months ago.
Yeah.
So it's really much cheaper to solve the problem than to not do it. It's just crazy amounts. And then thirdly, what happens is that these tiny pieces of plastic, they end up in fish. And what these plastic pieces do is that they attract toxic chemicals from the surrounding water onto the plastic. So this plastic is almost like a toxic pill that transports these chemicals into the food chain. And that's, of course, a food chain that also includes us humans. So with all these potential health effects associated with that. So it's, I think it's roughly 3 billion people that have fish as an important element of their diet. Of course, that's a pretty big deal as well.
Is there some numbers out there on the amount of microplastics already in the average fish that those people consume who are so heavy on their fish in diets? Is there something?
It depends on the species and the sort of the life cycle of the fish. But for some fish, for example, in the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, roughly half of the lantern fish that you see there, which are then being consumed by the bigger fish like the tuna and the swordfish, etc., they have plastic in them. So it's pretty big amounts.
So it's pretty bad as it is now, huh? and an urgent, extremely urgent matter from all those perspectives. Huh?
Yeah. But then again, I think it's a bad situation. But first of all, it can become much worse because right now we see that 92% of the plastics are still large objects. And of course, what happens if we don't clean those up, then over the next few decades, all of that will also become microplastics. And then you have basically 10 times more of that stuff out there. But then on the other hand, I also think that it's a solvable problem. You know, as long as we remove it and we prevent more stuff from going in, which is what we're also working on right now on the rivers, I think, the ocean can become clean again.
So you say it's a solvable problem. At the same time, you have like some of the most renowned scientists telling you that you're completely full of rubbish and it's not going to happen and it's not possible. Right. And he's talking nonsense. So how do you deal with that? And how do you have such self-confidence and so much self-belief that you just know and keep going against all that criticism? Isn't that hard?
Maybe one point of, correct. I don't think they were really renowned scientists. There were of people that most of their publications were about social media and things like that. So, for example, the chief scientist, former chief scientist of the NOAA, is the American Oceanographic Institute is advising us. We have great scientists in the team. So, but still, it is fair to say that at the beginning we received a lot of criticism from basically the entire plastic pollution community, saying, well, you know, it's impossible, shouldn't do it. So the way I dealt with that was to really just rationally analyze all the arguments and to see, well, is it based on facts or is it just an assumption or is it simply not true? And when I did that, most of the things were kind of unfounded. So, for example, people were saying, well, all the plastic is deep in the water column, so you can't get to it, or all of it is microplastics, or things will break immediately. And what we did was we basically used those lists of arguments as kind of a recipe of the things that we should be working on and should be studying. And basically, one by one, we were able to tick them off. Yeah, so I think it's important to distinguish between sort of good criticism and bad criticism. And, you know, the good criticism is, you know, you should really listen to, because, I mean, how silly would it be to ignore that? Because, you know, the only thing you care about is making this a success. And if somebody else says, well, you know, you should do it this way, not that way, and it's actually a good argument, you know, how silly would that be to ignore that? Because it would only help you, you know, advance your objective. But then, you know, unfortunately, that's, you know, the kind of criticism that's in the minority. I think the majority is just kind of not really truthful, or, you know, ideology based. For example, you know, there is this big point about, well, we shouldn't spend resources on cleaning up. We should just prevent it from going into the ocean. Now, of course, now we are also working on that. We do both sides of the equation, intercepting plastic in rivers before it reaches the oceans. But then again, I think humanity can do more than one thing at the same time. And this plastic that's in the ocean doesn't go away by itself. So if you want to solve the problem, you have to address that. And I suppose that people didn't really like that.
I think it's so strong, the respect that you're able to show towards your critics, as you just said now. Like in my career, I wasn't strong enough to really sit down and have a think about what the critics are saying and if there's anything that might be founded. But the way you're using it, or seem to use it to your advantage,
yeah.
And it's like free advice in the end,
exactly.
from some who might actually know something.
Right.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's really strong.
Yeah. There should be more good criticism.
So keep it coming. Yeah. So dear right. critics, keep it coming.
Right.
It's only making you stronger, and it's only going to help you.
Exactly. Good criticism, not the bad.
Yeah, of course. Can you take us through like the most challenging period for you? And what did you learn in that period about yourself, about what you were doing?
Yeah. So 1 year ago, so we, to give a bit of history, so past few years, we've been working on developing the system to clean the plastic from the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. After all those years of work, we finally launched the system, September 2018. And 1 month later, we realized, okay, it's not catching plastic. So what we saw was that the system was moving at roughly the same speed as the plastic, which meant that the plastic wasn't coming in. And then, you know, we thought, okay, that's pretty bad, but we can learn from this and see how we can adjust it. You know, it can't be much worse than this. And then, of course, it did become come worse, where just before New Year's 2019, the system actually broke into two. So an 18-meter end section disconnected from the rest of the system, which forced us to tow the system back to land.
Man, that's hard.
So exactly a year ago, you know, we're sitting in the office just thinking, wow, okay, we just spent so much time and energy and resources on this first system, and it was really kind of this make or break moment, and well, literally broke. And that was a tough moment to kind of not be influenced by emotions too much, and by really trying to think of a rational course forward to see how we can resolve it. So I think it was a few days of really dark days, and then fortunately, you know, there's so much energy in the team as well that kind of helped each other. I think we really helped each other there to basically say, okay, let's look at this. What were the causes? Let's rationally analyze it. You know, do the root cause analysis. Like, go back to the drawing board and let's give it another try. And fortunately, you know, half a year later, we finally managed to catch the first plastic. But yeah, 1 year ago, really bad. That day.
Geez, it's nice. I think you're such a calculator with everything, even like with action course and everything. So I think your power really seems to be in preparation. Like you extract such confidence from being prepared for any action course that you're about to take with the company. And right, is that the case?
Yeah, well, it's kind of the only way is forward, right? And yeah, it's just about every moment thinking, okay, what's the best action I could take right now? What has the highest leverage? What has the highest chance of success? And realizing that a lot of it has to be trial and error, and that most of the lessons you get sort of the hard way and the painful way.
Failures are the best opportunities to grow and improve and become better, right?
Yeah.
Unless they're too big.
Yes.
We don't want those ones.
No. So there is, it's kind of...
There's good and bad failures.
Right. It's this, in Silicon Valley, there's almost this, so this strange love affair with failure where people say failure is good. Well, failure is still bad. Shouldn't fail. But of course, if there is a failure, you should try and learn as much from it as possible.
You have like 80 employees now. Or is that right?
About 100 now.
About 100,
yeah.
Huh?
Yeah.
So what do you do to keep them inspired in such a moment of huge failure where to them, because they probably don't have the vision that you do or the confidence that you do, to them, it's the end. This is not going to happen. The critics are, the good critics are right and the bad critics, everybody's right.
Yes.
This is not going to happen. What do you do in that moment to keep them motivated and keep the inspiration in them going? Was there something particular that you can remember that you did?
I think a lot of it is just about leading by example. Most things fail because people give up too early. So it's just about keeping going and never giving up. Yeah, just showing, sort of radiating confidence and a positive attitude towards it. I think that that helps the team. And also just, this is something I learned too recently, is that it's also really important to not always position yourself as the person with the solutions, but also kind of giving it back to the team. Okay, so how would you solve it? And because, giving people responsibility actually empowers them to do great work.
That's something that I've just learned as well, because I have a small group of employees now, much smaller than yours, but we're like 15 or 16 now in Monaco as well, working on all my different initiatives and businesses, very focused on environment as well. And of course, they always really ask, like, make sure they want to have a very clear vision.
Right.
And I'm always trying, like, I'm always forcing myself to give a very clear vision, but sometimes I don't have it actually. So I'll be thinking about what you say now, and maybe just also admit that sometimes that I don't have the clear vision, and I welcome input. That's a cool thought.
And well, a certain sense of humility and showing your vulnerability and saying I don't know everything. And I think it's especially hard to make the transition for sort of tech oriented founders, because you are programmed as an inventor and engineer to find solutions to problems, right? And then to say to your team, well, okay, I don't have the solution right now. What do you think should be the solution? That's a really hard transition, but it's important, because eventually, especially with 100 people, it's not about, it's not only about what's the best ideas coming from my brain, but it's really about how do I make sure that we get all the best ideas out of all these 100 brains, because they are much smarter than I am.
It's incredible the skill set that's required from you in that case. You need to be the best inventor. You need to be the best leader. You need to know how to sell and market things, which you do really well as well on social media. I mean, it's amazing content. So you really need to be so multifaceted to be able to have success.
I suppose I'm quite a generalist in that I also actually really enjoy switching from very different kind of problems throughout the day. One point in time you're sitting in a meeting about recycling, you're talking about covalent bonds and some chemistry stuff, and the next moment it's about communication, next moment is about production or structural engineering. That's part of my sort of job that I enjoy most.
I think that's possibly your greatest asset, that you're such a generalist. And I would like to take Elon Musk as an example as well. It's rare that an engineer is able to be such a great storyteller as well, for example. And Elon Musk is an unbelievable engineer and
really
an unbelievable storyteller and marketeer. And it's the combination which has made Tesla into such a force with such a following and to take on such an industry. And I think that's something probably that you are similar. You don't need to confirm, but I'm sure that you're very similar in that sense.
I think it's just about doing what's the best thing or what's the most important thing for the mission. And it's important to realize if you want something to be successful, there's always these two sides. You have the making it happen, and you know, so the supply and the demand side, basically. And you know, just like with Tesla, they need to build great products, but they also need to have, you know, the world wanting those great products. And the same thing is here. If nobody cares about cleaning the ocean, it's not going to happen. So it's really important that a lot of people care about it and spread the word and, you know, help donate and find supporters and partners.
Where can my listeners donate?
Ah, well, so
the ocean. I'll join in at the same on the same go.
So on theoceancleanup.com, all the information is there. Thanks for your help there.
So we're all going to donate. That's nice.
Yeah.
Well, support you on the next push.
Thanks. Yeah. And but maybe coming back to the sort of the generalist point. So it's just about being so passionate about the goal that you kind of able to learn yourself all the skills that you need to do. I think every listener is familiar with, you know, for example, in school, there's things that interest you, things that don't interest you. How hard it is to learn things or to try and learn things that don't interest you.
Oh my goodness.
It's really difficult. So, you know, so by being extremely passionate about the thing you're working on, you know, there's all these subcomponents that may be very different disciplines, but you'll be able to familiarize yourself with them just because you're passionate about it.
So what was the most dry and horrible book that you had to get through recently?
Oh. Most of my books aren't very, well, they may be dry, but not really hard to get through.
No? Oh, because you said some areas are just not interesting, but you have to get through them and become an expert even in that space.
Well, my point is more that, yeah, if you're passionate about the overarching objective, it's not hard to do those things.
Okay.
In my experience.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah. And when I called you, I think it was the end of we emailed, I think, the end of last year.
Yeah.
You said, Nico, it's all great. Thank you very much for your invitation, but I'm very sorry. I'm not going to be able to attend anything because I have to put in 100-hour weeks at the moment to try and get this beta system to be a success towards the end of 2019.
Yeah, sorry for declining that.
But, but how do you, I mean, do you manage to keep some balance in such a insane workload that you put into that?
No,
completely out of balance.
I don't even know what balance means, to be honest. But of course, yeah. Surely, again, I suppose it's more of a symptom from being passionate about it than something fundamental. But for most, if not all, great work, you just have to put in a lot of time and effort. And just last year, you know, it was such a make or break year. I mean, if that beta system wouldn't have functioned, you know, we would be in a pretty dodgy situation right now, I think. And you know, if with the river systems, if that we didn't pull it off. So actually, that's another thing. Like 1 year ago, so we're doing these two things in parallel: cleaning up what's already in the ocean, intercepting in rivers what's not yet reached the ocean to prevent it from going into the ocean. And a year ago, we were already working on those two projects. And on the ocean, the system failed. And on the riverside, we had exactly one system, which had been stuck in customs for a year already in Indonesia. So really, it was even worse than probably people saw from the outside. But then we managed to get it out. And now we have two systems operational, thousands of kilos per day being extracted from rivers. And the ocean system, managed to get that to work. But yeah, really on both fronts, it was a make or break year last year, and it was just important to not have any distractions. But actually, it was the first time sort of end of last year that I've felt personally that I've even reached a limit. That was
that happens. Boyan has a limit.
Well, I didn't know that was possible, because you know, it doesn't really feel, when you're passionate about something, it doesn't really feel like work. And I was just, and suddenly it did feel like work, and that was quite disconcerting to me. And so then, like last 2 weeks of the year, I just took off and just read a bunch of books. And that was really quite necessary, because it was a really difficult year. But again, looking back, I think it was worth it.
So one more common theme there, I think you see across all incredible leaders is reading. I think it's so powerful, and I'm pushing myself as well to read as much as I can on just personal development books and books that are relevant to the mission that you want to undertake. So I think that's another important lesson to the listener. Final words then, can you say what you wish for your success now to look like in, I mean, of course, without going into too much detail, but you're deploying your first full system. Hmm. When is that going to happen? And what do you hope that that's going to be able to achieve in the Pacific Ocean?
Yeah, on the ocean side, the system, I think, will take roughly a year to be ready for that. So this year will fully just be dedicated to developing what we call System 2, which will be the first full-scale, fully operational cleanup system, and will kind of be this blueprint for the whole fleet of systems that we need to deploy to really clean the whole patch. So that's going to be this year, so probably deployment next year. And then on the river side, we now have two systems operational, and then aim to scale this up to another dozen or so systems by the end of the year. So throughout Southeast Asia and Central America, yeah, that should put us on track to hopefully have 1,000 of these systems in the ocean or in all the rivers by 2025, which should stop 80% of all plastic going to the ocean from actually reaching the ocean. So a few busy years ahead for sure.
And then soon we'll be able to buy awesome products as well, right? Or are they already available from your plastic that you gathered?
Exactly. So that's actually the third thing that we're working on, is because I think one of the main problems is that plastic doesn't have any value. So by using the story of the cleanup to create value, emotional value to this material, we hope to actually create sort of this business model to keep the cleanup going. And we'll be trying this out this year. So in September, we'll be launching the first product, 100% made from plastic from the Great Pacific Garbage Patch.
I'll cover it on my social media as well then. I'll support you with the launch.
Brilliant. And and actually people can already kind of claim their seat in line on our website for that first product. We haven't shared what the product is, but if you want to put money in something you don't know what it's going to be, this is your opportunity.
So you already have a queue of people waiting for a product that they don't know what it is.
I think it's about 6,000 people have now put money in for.
Amazing. How much do I have to put?
50 to bucks.
50 bucks 50 and I get bucks. To be the 6,000 and first.
Yes. Yeah. I think, you know, we only have a limited amount of products that we can launch in September, because we only have a limited amount of plastic now, because it's just a beta system. Yeah, so definitely if you want to make sure that you don't miss the boat, yeah, I would recommend signing up now.
Yeah, but this is even better. It's the first limited edition batch.
It's the first ever plastic from the Great Pacific Garbage Patch.
Ultra special, not to miss out on.
You can own a piece of the garbage patch. Who doesn't want that? And it's going to be a beautiful, beautiful, sustainable product. So it's pretty exciting too, I think.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Bojan. I think everybody loved the inspiration and all the insights you gave. Are you a big Max Verstappen fan then, being Dutch?
Oh, yeah. I was watch.
Yeah. Big supporter.
Yeah.
He's amazing, huh?
Quite, yeah. It's pretty aggressive, but it's a joy to watch, especially if he starts at the back of the field. It's awesome. Yeah, it's quite special.
When he goes out of the race, you know that the race is only going to be half as exciting.
Right.
So it's always if he goes out, it's always a huge disappointment for everybody.
Very true. Yeah.
And I think it's going to be cool to watch he's like the new generation against the old generation, which is Lewis Hamilton.
Yeah.
Could be that this is the year where they really go head to head if Max gets the car good enough from Red Bull.
Yeah.
So I think it could be an epic F1 season. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Hey, cheers.
Bye bye, everybody.